at the time at Cornell in the U.S., right. had written those papers
right.
with a woman
right.
called Elizabeth Monroe.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this is very strange, right? And before that, actually, she had worked with, she was an American, and she had worked with a very famous mathematician,
right.
Emmy Noether, at Bryn Mawr. So it was a very promising career
yeah.
in terms of, oh, so you turned it on? Okay, thank you. Very promising career. And then she actually gave birth in 45, right after the end of the war.
Right.
And her son had a very serious infection at birth.
Right.
And he was one of the first civilians treated with antibiotics.
Right.
Because it was just after VJ Day, so August,
right.
mid-August, yeah. 45. So he survived, but
yeah.
he had had serious brain damage.
Yeah.
And he was severely mentally handicapped
right.
after that.
Right.
So she had to quit science to take care of him.
Yeah.
And but she, from what I understand, she was too... She couldn't handle just staying at home.
Right.
She had to do something of her
yeah.
days. And so
yeah.
she started getting involved in parents' movement for disability
right.
studies and
right.
well, the changing of the laws for treatment of disabled, mentally disabled
right.
citizens. And when the 60s came around, John F. Kennedy hired her
right.
to be on a panel to review the legislation. She had been such
right.
an important activist. And
right.
she kept leading a life of advocacy, but also a very... So everyone who's met her and who's, you know, talked about her mentioned how important research was for her as well,
right.
since that she was encouraging the parents' movement to collaborate with the scientists to try
right.
to figure out what are the needs and what are the,
right.
the you know, some clinical and some fundamental research with the mental disabilities. So I thought this was a very interesting
yeah, sure.
story. And what I found out is that the people who knew her from the medical world had no idea what she had done before.
Right.
Or, well, she knew that they knew that she had studied at Cambridge, but didn't quite understand the,
yeah.
The importance of what she was doing and the importance of the people she was
right.
working with, especially.
Yeah.
And so I got in contact with the center that's named up to her. And they said, oh, I would be very interested if you could
right.
write.
Right.
We're thinking of writing a... maybe a collection of essays about
right.
her for
right.
her the centennial of her birth.
Right.
And because this is a part of my field's history in which I have a lot invested, right?
Right.
In a sense I'm standing on the shoulders of those
right.
giants who work on this. It's a great opportunity to get to learn about the intellectual
right.
history of the
right.
field. And about this very peculiar character
yeah.
who in a sense she didn't have a great research career. She had an
oh.
extremely promising one
right.
and just was cut short
yeah.
very
yeah.
early on.
Yeah.
And so that's a pretext to revisit,
yeah,
in a sense, that history.
Yeah, well, I remember this differential analyzer, the Meccano model. Hartree, of course, in Manchester.
Yeah.
That may be the model he built in Manchester. My
yes.
father built another one,
mm-hmm.
which was in Cambridge, which I remember. I think it's now in New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Okay, so you know. I didn't know if you...
Well, I try to keep a distant interest in these things. And I went to the computer lab in Cambridge for some centenary or other. Well, it was the first computer after the war, which Wilkes
mm-hmm.
had built. EdTech, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think it was 50 years of EdTech or something like that.
Yeah, probably 1996
so
it would have been.
My father, of course, founded the mathematical laboratory in Cambridge, and but before the days of computers. So he's well remembered there. So I was invited, rather perhaps as you come today, to say what I remembered about those days. And so that's why I don't really understand these things. I just keep an eye on it.
No, but yeah, so the... I mean, it is a very interesting slice of history. And
yeah,
it was,
yes, indeed.
I mean, there was actually a military component also, which is
yes. yeah.
very unexpected times and unusual times for science as well.
Yes, my father was involved in trajectories of shells and this sort of thing. And in fact, he always said that the Battle of El Alamein people didn't realise that for the first time the British Army had a gun that would knock out the German tanks. Previously, the anti-tank guns that Britain had just bounced off their tanks. But to Dan Almain, they had the 12-pounder, which had a sufficient velocity or whatever, to knock them out, and that was a key factor in the Battle of Alamein, because the Germans came up through this valley, and the British were dug in on the sides of the valley, and they knocked them all out. And that, of course, so we had this, that's where the tide of war turned, really. So he was involved with that sort of thing. And the mathematical laboratory was involved in the war effort, but what they did, I don't know. I used to go down and that differential analyzer, one had two handles, and one had to keep the crosswires over the over a curve. I mean, I had no idea what it was doing, and I was hired just to keep the crosswires over the curve. So, you know, I saw a bit of what was going on.
So, you mean you worked there? You
well, no, I mean, I was a schoolboy, but
there's a way to spend the afternoon to keep you out of trouble.
Well, yes, you know, I went down. I wouldn't say frequently, but my father wanted somebody to do this rather mundane task of keeping the thing following the curve, so somebody like me was a good idea. Anyway, so I used to go down to the mathematical laboratory. But of course I never understood the mathematics because I'm no mathematician. Anyway,
Please, so you remember... So the students know you, presumably, that you were...
Oh, they know. I mean, when I was in the lab, they know who I was, yes.
Yeah. And did you know them? Did you chat with them ever?
I mean, I remember Devonshire, Colson. I won't say I remember them, but, you know, I was... But my parents were very hospitable, and the research fellows were in almost part of the family, you know. So there used to be just talk at table at home about them, which is why I remember Elizabeth Munro. I mean, her name came up quite frequently. And as I think I told you, they had these tennis parties. And my mother was a very hospitable lady, so they'd come up and have tea and that sort of thing. But my memory is of the general buzz that was going on, rather than remembering
the specifics. Okay.
Yeah. And I know my father was very fond of Elizabeth Munro, you know.
But was he fond of all his graduate students?
Yes.
So he had a very good relationship.
Oh, yes, he had a good relationship with all of them. Not so much, actually, but don't quote me on this, with Wilkes, but...
Oh, really?
Yeah. But Devonshire was a great favourite of his. Well, I say favourite, you know, he was...
Oh, they worked together for almost 10 years.
Yeah, I was always hearing about Devonshire. And of course the names which are so familiar to you, like Dirac and so on, were household buzz, you know, Dirac said, so and so, I'm going to meet Dirac. You know, it was all sort of, they were in the general ambience of what I was living.
They went to meetings together.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Right.
They had debates or...
Yes, I mean, they just met in the... You know Cambridge?
The university? Well, this or the city...
Well, that's... It was a small place in those days, and there was a lot of interaction between people. Dirac, of course, was at St. John's, if I remember rightly. But he was in Bristol too, wasn't he? My father started in Bristol.
Yeah, he did his undergrad in Bristol.
Right.
And I think he was encouraged to move. So there was a mathematic professor there who was actually a collaborator of your father, a gentleman called Hasse, or Hasse.
I do remember that name, just, yes.
So in Dirac's biography, he's recorded as being the person who actually encouraged him to apply to Cambridge.
Oh, right, yes, yeah. Obviously, I know much more about my father than anything about Elizabeth Munro. My father went to Heidelberg in the late 1920s, which was a centre for quantum mechanics at that time. I've forgotten you'll mention the names and I'll remember, but...
I think Heisenberg.
Yes, and, that's right. Heisenberg, was he at Heidelberg? He could well have been.
Yes, it's written in his... so he went for sabbatical, I think, in
yes, Heidelberg. We all went as a family.
Okay, the, yes, but so you were very young at the time.
Three.
You don't remember.
Yes, I was about three. And my father learned German, and is said to have spoken German reasonably well, but with an accent. And so he was very much there at the sort of origin of quantum mechanics, and then came back to Bristol as professor there. Where,
and he had a plan after that, right? He had a vision of what he wanted to do.
That I don't know, but...
Well, that's how... Okay, that's how yes. It's presented in his biographies.
Right,
he came back with this vision of using the tool of quantum mechanics to examine chemistry.
Yeah, right. And so he was actually a professor of theoretical physics in Bristol. And, of course, as you'll be well aware, he was very interested in electrons, and their charge and so on. So he was in at the very beginning of quantum mechanics. And then he moved to Cambridge, I think in 1932. And then there was great excitement when he got his fellowship at the Royal Society, which of course was a great thing in those days. And then he developed this group of research students who were with him right until the beginning of the war when he had to move away. It was a very disruptive period because he was living away from home.
But he stayed at Cambridge for a few years before moving to the Ministry of Supply. I think he moved in 1942 to the Ministry of Supply.
Well, he was working there, but he was working on armament research. There were a lot of committees. And there was a place called Fort Halstead. He sort of evolved into the Ministry of Supply.
Okay.
From the work presumably they were doing in Cambridge, and he was travelling a lot, going to meetings. I think there was no research going on really in the war.
No, there's nothing. From what I understand, the machines, right, the differential analyzer and the other mathematical tools that the mathematical laboratory had. Were co-opted by the Ministry of Supply
That's right. So it became part of the research.
Yeah. So it was Hartree's machine as well. And everything that it was able to add, basically, in the country. Yeah.
So what they were doing, I don't know.
I'm supposed to... I'll look into this eventually, but they're saying that the differential analyzer was not precise enough to do ballistic calculations, but it was enough to do explosive research.
Oh, was it?
Where they could... Yes. And actually, interestingly enough, Munro, after spending 2 years...
Yes. What years was she in Cambridge?
1936 to 1939.
Oh, right. Just beginning of the war.
Just before. She, from what she said in a later interview, apparently she was planning to stay. Because Leonard Jones, your dad, asked for all his students to participate in his group.
Yes.
And she was planning to stay there and be part of the war effort. And I think in the fall... of 1939, the British government voted that no foreigners could be part of that effort.
Right,
so even though she had been running the machine, some of the most involved people involved running the machine, she had to leave.
Right.
So that's when her plans changed. But she also became part of the war effort, also doing explosive research.
Oh, right.
She from 1941 to 1945 until she gave birth.
So
she would, I guess the same intellectual communities found the same...
Right.
Outpouring for their skills. Yeah. And I'm sure your father didn't know what she was doing and she didn't know what your father was doing. Yeah. It's all very secret. And
It was a tragedy, really, for scientific research at that time because it all came to a halt, this applied work.
I mean, it's a very interesting period also because actually the tools that came out after the war completely changed... the conductive science. I mean, the appearance of computers, for instance, which made things that were completely impossible even to
impossible.
Consider. Yeah. I think, and the fact that there were so much resources focused on it.
Yes.
So it's this, you know, disruptive.
Yeah.
But in complex ways,
it had an outcome. Yes.
You don't know, yes.
Yeah, my father used to have a little calculator with a handle. And he, at home, he had a calculator which it had a thing like a typewriter, and it was just for addition. But that's how they handled the bigger numbers at that time.
His adding machine, then?
Yeah, it was a pure adding machine. It would be like a cash register, really.
So you went to Cambridge starting as a student in 1942.
That's right, yes, yeah.
Right, so you switched from being the witness in the lab to being a student.
Well, I went to boarding school in about 1939, I suppose. 1940, perhaps.
Okay.
So I was away from home then. And my parents... My father was away in the war, really. He was... one of his titles was Chief Superintendent of Armament Research, and he was based then in Fort Halstead, which is in Kent. And so he was away week after week and stayed in digs there and came home for the occasional weekend. Of course, there was no petrol either. It's not like now when you can just jump in the car and go home.
So you had to get train passes, or you had to...
Well, petrol was rationed, so we had so many coupons a month. Doubtless he had some coupons for his work, but it was everything was very restricted. So he was really away from home, I would have thought, from 1940 to 45.
The large chunks at a time, months at a time.
And yeah, he just came home for weekends. And my mother was living in that house and kept the home fires burning. I went to boarding school in about 1939, I suppose.
Okay.
And I went to a school that was in Norfolk, which is on the east coast. But then it was evacuated down to Cornwall, so we were on a peninsula headland in Cornwall, which I spent the war down there, really.
Okay.
So I was just home on the weekends, in the holidays. So it was a very peculiar time, very odd.
Did you have siblings?
Yes, I've got a sister. Yes. Okay. Yeah. And so she was at boarding school also.
Okay. Different boarding school, but yeah, the same recipe.
She was somewhere near Bath. And of course we went by trains to those sort of places.
Okay. So you said your parents entertained students, and you said you had a tennis court in the back, so it was fairly common for students to come and play tennis.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So when I was looking through the archives at Churchill...
That's my father, obviously. Is that Devonshire?
That's a good question. That's what I've been trying to...
I think that's Devonshire. He had that rather long face. And that would be in our tennis court. Oh, that's Elizabeth Monroe's, yeah.
Yes, that's...
Yeah. I mean, that's how... You know, I have the dimmest possible memory, but that's how I remember her. As a tall, very charming person, probably with dark hair.
And what gave the situation
away? Is that Corner?
That's what I think it is, from comparing... Okay,
so I can't remember Corner very well, but I think that's Corner. And I think that's Devonshire.
Because they worked... I mean, Corner also worked throughout the war with your father. Indeed, he became...
What happened to him?
So he wrote a book about ballistics in 1950,
right.
And that's as far as I've gotten.
Right.
He's disappeared.
Yeah. Well, they used to come and they'd play tennis all Saturday afternoon, and they'd have tea down. You know, if we've got a lovely day like this, have tea down at the bottom of the garden, and I was too young to play tennis or anything like that, so I was aware of this, and that's interesting.
And your father was a good tennis player, or
no? I don't think so. But they it was social tennis, you know,
okay.
not Wimbledon and that stuff. I think tennis was quite different in those days, more like paddleball than modern tennis. And the grass court, whether it was any good, I don't know.
It was a way to carry on the conversation rather than the
yes,
the
it, was,
sport.
It was a form of entertainment, form of socializing. That's a lovely picture.
Yeah. It's one of a kind, actually. In the archives, most of the pictures that are
Yeah.
Or they are pretty formal, your father posing for a portrait, and that's the only casual casual one. And they all seem to be having a good time.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So when I first started approaching this project, I was reading what Coulson wrote about your father.
Yes.
And I think Coulson had a difficult early days in graduate school as a PhD student. And what your father and him thought were supposed to be the way to conduct research were slightly different. So it left the impression of your father being a pretty strict man.
He was very, I can remember him coming for a meal at home, and one of his research students, I don't know who, had prepared a manuscript for a paper. He hadn't read the references, he just quoted them. This very much upset my father. You mustn't quote things you haven't read. You know, there was a strictness about him. But he regarded the research team as a family, really. And I think you get that impression there.
So that's why I was really happy to find this photo, because they're all smiling, and she more than the rest. So clearly they must have had a pleasant interaction.
It was very casual when they came up, but I think he was a purist, you know.
He wanted it right.
Oh, he wanted it correct. Yes.
There's also another picture. So there's this list that I found also in the archives of. A list of students that he wrote in
38-39. Yep. Oh, there's Cornish. I can't remember him. I don't know those at all.
The bottom four, okay.
I don't know.
But Corner, Devonshire, Lucas, and Monroe. So interestingly, they all went on to have careers of sort. S.T. Ma might be the most interesting life also of those. I don't think he worked very long for your father. I don't think they went along. He worked for A.H. Wilson at Bristol for a while, and with another fellow whose name I forget now. But he was Chinese.
Right.
He came from Beijing. And during the war, he went back to China and was teaching at... So the main Chinese universities that built a campus off...
Right.
The cities away from the coast, where the Chinese government was in exile, in a sense, from, and he was faculty there, and he was teaching a very famous Chinese physicist called Xian Yang. He was one of the, and then moved on to Australia after the Chinese Revolution, and died in the '60s, apparently of a suicide. So,
well, you see, I recognize Corner, so you know he was somebody else. Those names are very familiar to me. Really, my father had two families of research students. There was that family, and then there was the post-war family with Popel and... I can't remember the name. But life was a bit different after all. Popel, of course, went on to a Nobel Prize.
Yes, he did. In a sense, he got the Nobel Prize for the research program that your father had in mind.
Yeah, that's right. My father's research career was totally interrupted by the war. I think if it hadn't been for a war, he would have...
Yes and no. So, I mean, obviously these are difficult things to say afterward, but the other thing is that I think it was a little too ambitious for the computational resources available.
Right, yes.
So if he had started after the war, it would have been...
Because Popel's work was entirely computational, as far as I know, having read his obituary.
So exactly the sort of work that he was trying to do with a differential integrator, but on a scale that the new machines allowed. So obviously it's hard to say what could have happened or what if.
Yes.
But it's very interesting. So you said the two families were very separate.
I called them a family research unit, but they were a bit of a family. I inherited it really because I had a lot of research students. And, you know, we had them out at home often.
Did anyone stay in touch with you?
None of those people.
None of those people.
No. Coulson, of course, was a keen Methodist and wrote a number of books on science and religion, which I have one or two. But that was a different... I had no contact with him.
Okay. Because he's the one who is the one student that I know who actually refused to work for the war effort.
Oh, is that
so? Yes. So your dad asked him.
Oh, yes, right.
And he said, I'm a pacifist. I cannot, in conscience.
Yes, he was a very religious person. And my father respected him, but I have the impression of a slightly austere person, perhaps. Not socially, but probably because of my knowledge of his books.
So,
lost touch with him.
So your father also described himself as a Christian.
The paper I've got here won't be actually. I don't think they're any interest in that. But all the stuff here to do with my father. A few years ago, I thought I'd write a slight autobiography, and so I wrote a little piece about my father here, which I don't think it's of, but some of it might be interesting.
Do you mind sharing this with me?
It's probably on the computer. I can print off a copy if you want.
We also have ways to take pictures of it if there's anything.
Right, yeah. Right. Oops. There's a description of the middle part here, which is the house you've just seen.
Oh, the house he built. Oh, no, the one in
Cambridge.
You seem to have led a pretty interesting life too, from what
I've had a very good life, really, but it's in retirement I find difficult, I have to say, because you have no goals when you're in retirement, you've got no schedule, and
they force you to the retirement age of fairly young for people who are active,
yes.
Like you.
You know, I had to retire at 65. Oh, look, this might be interesting. The atmosphere of academic life in Cambridge before the war. That might be of interest to you, I think.
I mean, I don't want to take the pages out of order if...
I mean, this is me, I'm afraid. I just thought I'd write down my memories. I did this about 5 years ago, in case anybody ever was interested.
So I noticed that you wrote your first paper, actually. You're fairly young.
Yes.
Right.
Well, I was
22.
It was interesting. Oh, you've done your research, haven't you?
That's my job.
I left school in 1944 when I was 17, which is rather early. And so I had a degree when I was 19. And that was exactly at the end of the war, you see, it was 45, 46. So I remember VE Day in Cambridge when the victory in Europe.
Oh, so you were in Cambridge.
I was in Cambridge at that time. And then there came the spectre of national service, because everybody had to go in the army or the services when they were 19 or 20. But at that time, of course, it was 1946. So England was demobilising. So they didn't want new people in the army. Mm-hmm. So a number of us were diverted to civilian posts, and I was diverted to a medical research council post in Birmingham, which was a very formative period. And I started off wanting to do farming, but changed to medicine in 46, and then went into this medical research post with a man called John Squire under the Medical Research Council. And that, as you say, is when we first wrote a paper. And I then, for myself, developed this vision of trying to practice medicine but in a scientific manner, and to try and apply such limited science as I had to the problems I actually saw in the clinic, which is how I spent my life, really.
You made a successful career out of it.
A lot of controlled physical trials and so on. And I had my own, not mine in a possessive sense, but I worked with research students, which I got funding for, and they did things with me. It was all very non-theoretical. Though, funnily enough, I do have a slight mathematical urge. You know, I gave a lecture on decision theory in disease I was interested in. In a quite early time of decision theory, I do have a slight mathematical
tendency.
Funny enough, my sons do. They're all, they can all do mathematics. They're none of the mathematicians that I've got.
But they're comfortable with.
They're comfortable with maths and physics and that sort of thing, but at a very low level.
But you did your degree in
natural science.
Natural science.
Yes, I did. Yes, yeah. I did physics. I did chemistry, physiology, and zoology.
Okay.
And I'd done maths, physics, and chemistry in my high school certificate, so I had a fairly general background, and I still take an interest in it. There's some very good programs on the television in the evenings sometimes, some of which have been on a lot of them on the history of science. There was a very interesting series on the development of chemistry, and I feel if I'd been taught the periodic table in the way that they explained how it had evolved, I might have remembered it. But of course, I mean, I learned it off by heart.
Well, I know the program you're talking about, yeah. Actually. Yeah.
It was very how they first of all arranged the atoms in increasing weight, and that didn't obviously make a sequence. Then they had this idea, I don't know who did it, but somebody had the idea of grouping them not only like that, but then bringing them around so that you put them in common properties, which led to the periodic table. So that sort of thing interests me. But if I'd been taught that way, I think I'd have...
Did you take a class with your father at Cambridge, or...
No.
So he was not...
Nothing to do with that, no. No.
And...
He and I were very good friends, actually.
Do you need help?
We used to go long walks in the country where we discuss all sorts of things, but not mathematical physics.
Okay.
But in there, there's... No, that's about me. In that one, there's a description of a lecture which my father gave after the war. In fact, the year he died, I think, in Oxford. In which he's talking about electrons. He took immense pains in teaching.
Mm. So he liked, he cared?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
He took, his 9 o'clock lectures, which took great trouble over. And I think you'll find that the only record of them is Coulson's notes are in one of those archives, mm-hmm. probably in Coulson's archives.
No, they've been transferred to your father's archives, because they thought
that's the tragedy of it, you see. Stuff my father did was never reached what you might call the popular scientific press. What have you got here?
The atmosphere.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, you see here, my father's research students and associates were commonly spoken of at family meals. As a boy, I became familiar with great names in contemporary science, all in touch with my father, such as Hertzberg, Dirac, Niels Bohr, Rutherford and Linus Pauling. The latter came to lunch one day, and my mother was disconcerted because he refused her cooking and took only cheese. Unknown to her, he was a vegetarian. I well remember her discomfort because she had made a big effort for such a distinguished visitor. Science was in the air, it was exciting. That was home we caught that atmosphere.
Linus Pauling was known to be quite a. An interesting character.
Yeah.
He had a second life as a scientist promoting the virtues of vitamin C.
That's right, he did, yes.
I'm sure you've heard
it. Very largely. Exactly. Yeah.
And those words would just go through you, basically, and enrich the environment rather than...
So these people sort of came to the house from time to time. So what was in that sort of buzz?
So you said you had a good relationship with your father.
Yes, we used to go long walks together. We talked all the time.
About philosophy, about...
Oh, about his work. I think I was somebody he could talk to without inhibition. And it's going to be reported or, you know. Mm. So, we both enjoyed walking. And, that's when I got to know him, really.
So you, as a teenager, before the war, or this is after
the war?
No,
this would be in my late teens.
Okay. So when you were a student, at the time when you were a student at Cambridge?
Yes, or before when I was at school too.
Okay.
The country walks were our relaxation.
You mentioned over the phone that he was teaching you science during those
walks.
Well,
no, I think it was, as I said, it was a sort of buzz, you know. One was living in a scientific atmosphere. We had family meals. It was very much a family in that house I showed you. We lived very much as a family. I mean, we sat down to... I can't remember if he came home for lunch. He used to go bicycling every morning down to the town. It was about 2.5 miles. And I can't remember if he came home for lunch. I think he did. And he'd bicycle up again and bicycle down again. So we had a lot of family meals. And he would say, Elizabeth Munro did so-and-so today or something, you know. It was just purely social. Yeah. So that's where I get to know these names like Corner and Devonshire and people.
So both my parents were computer scientists.
Oh, were they?
So I've lived this myself with... actually, when I was a young teenager, or even a teenager, I was convinced I would never go into computer science because I'd heard so much of it at home.
Right.
And it turns out I'm a computational person in the end. It caught up with me. So I understood a little the degree of your...
But it was, I didn't know these names, but they were just common buzz.
Of who was doing what and...
Yes, and, you know... The names familiar, like Iraq and so on.
So there's one name, interesting, that I ran into when I was going through the papers, is the name of W.G. Penny.
Oh, yes.
Who's known to be the father of the British nuclear bomb.
Yes, that's right. He was a research student.
So he was a research student of your father.
Yeah.
He did, I think, his second PhD.
Penny was a... household name. Yeah. And then he, I think, also went into the Ministry of Supply. Yeah. He was very much opposite my father, but on the nuclear side. And became very famous.
Yes, I think he came back after the war and I don't know if it was related to the relationship between your father and him, but the project fell onto the lap of your father's unit, the Ministry of Supply.
Did he?
From the ARE,
Armament
Research. Yeah. I forget what the E stands for.
Yes.
So, yeah. No, it's okay. You don't have any particular...
No, I mean, Penny's a very familiar name to me. And, my father often spoke of him. My memory of him is a rather well-built person. Physically. But I don't
know. Okay. Yeah, he seemed to have had also... His memoirs were published.
Oh, right.
He had this... Apparently, at his before his death, he burnt all of his archives. People who were trying to reconstruct what he had done had a harder time.
I don't think I've got the obituaries of some of them, because when I see them in the Times, I cut them out. But I don't think I've got Penny. I might have.
So you're the person who actually went through his study and collected all of his papers
after his death.
And eventually relayed those to the Churchill archives. Was your father a pack rat? Was there actually a lot of things that you threw away?
Awful. Yes, because you see, he kept notes of all his talks and speeches and so on. There were all his reprints. Files and box, you know. Drawers and drawers and stuff. What's this now? Well, that's different. Yes, that was from the Church of Art, I got it. I don't think you'll be interested in this, but say if you are. The Churchill archive writes this from time to time, as when you got in contact with them. And there was a man called Farmelo, I don't know what he's doing. Anyway. And you've obviously been, you know, there's a catalogue of the papers there.
Yes, yeah.
And this was a great grief to me. Abortive attempts to get my father's partially prepared manuscripts published, which I failed. Because, you see, I couldn't do it. So I had to go back to some of his later associates. And it's one of them said they would do it, but he didn't.
What
did it? What so the papers that he had left.
Yeah, oh, you see, there were a lot of half-written things, which was a great grief, because he would have written a more popular book, I think.
Oh, so, okay, this is not...
He wanted my father's notes for a monograph on group theory. And a man called Price was going to do them, I don't know. The idea of editing the elaboration of your father's lecture notes was slowly abandoned after they had been sent to me. Largely, as I remember it now, because of a spate of books on group therapy about just about that time, which were mostly rather more comprehensive in scope than your father's notes, which dealt mostly with applications to molecules. I cannot say now how and when the decision not to proceed was taken. There is one faint hope I may have just left the notes in one of the filing cabinets in the physics department of Bristol. Anyway, it all faded out. It was sad. Yeah, this is all about that.
This particular exchange about his notes.
Yeah, but... Here's a letter. It's many years since we corresponded about my father's papers. I've recently been approached by the Contemporary Scientific Archive Centre, which has been set up at Oxford under the auspices of the Royal Society and the Royal Commission on Historical Manuscripts. And that, I think, led to Churchill in due course.
Oh, this is how eventually you got in contact with Churchill.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they may have got... I dealt with this. This was on in Oxford at that time, the Contemporary Scientific Archive Centre,
mm-hmm.
the Indian Institute, Broad Street, Oxford.
So this was many years after. Really, this is
1973, yeah. 20 years after my father died. So the Contemporary Scientific Archive Centre would be prepared to pay any transfer costs involved in sending the papers to Oxford, because I had them for a long time. So it was difficult, actually. You know, one had all this stuff and didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, I imagine. So there's not as much sensitivity to this material at the time.
And I deposited his reprints, if he wanted to look at them, a complete set of reprints, with the library at the University of Kiel, which is where he was principal before he died.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where they are. But, I mean, there was a set of bound reprints, that being.
Of what he had read and what he had kept.
So that's what... Well, those were the published reprints.
Okay.
So they were published papers, bound in book form. So they're at Kiel.
And most manuscripts then were is what you sent to Churchill. What it was?
Oh, I sent to Churchill. They may have sent a reprint there. I can't remember.
No, not that I.
No, I just sent everything I got really. What I have is here, which is, as I say, probably of no interest to you, I'd imagine.
Q Do you want a table? Would it be...
Sure, sure.
Okay.
There was a silver salver, which... I don't know who gave it him. Which I gave to the theoretical... Which I gave to the Department of Computational Science in Cambridge, eventually. It had a curve on it. Let me look like that.
What's a silver salver, should I?
It's a silver dish.
Ah, okay.
And engraved on it was one of these curves, which was obviously something that's associated with my father.
Probably
given by his research students, I imagine.
So the computational lab would have it now?
They'll have it now, yes. Okay. Yes, exactly. As far as I know, it's in a
display cabinet.
In a display cabinet in the hall. And also his original little calculator, which I had. With a label written by me. But that's what he had at home. And this... Those were notes that I wrote for the Department of Computational Science. Now, of course, have you been there? It's an enormous, great big building.
I've not visited the inside. I've been to Theoretical Chemistry, though, which is where...
That's in Lidfield Road. Yes, I've not been there.
That's the chemistry laboratory.
Right. Well, this place is out along the Meddingley Road, and it's an enormous, great building, all full of people doing computational science, and directed by Wilkes. And when he died, I think, last year. And when they had this, whatever anniversary it would have been, must have been about 40s, must be the late 1940s. I should think it was the...
1946.
Probably the 50th anniversary, which would be 96. They asked me to write something, which is what I wrote. There it is.
Oh, so, okay, it was in 1999 that they did this. So it was 49.
So I went the whole day, which I heard about the development of computers.
Yeah. So interestingly, the man with whom I worked in Amsterdam moved to Cambridge 3 years ago, and he's the one who's occupying your father's chair.
Right.
So Jean-Pierre Hansen was the holder of that chair.
That's right. I only met him once.
And Dan Frenkel is now... current show. So
but Hansen moved off somewhere. I had an invitation to lunch with him, which I didn't take up before he moved. And so he moved, I lost touch.
Oh, he moved to Paris.
Paris.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, right. Yes, he had to... To get his pension in France, he had to go and work one more year in Paris.
Yes.
So he
yes.
moved back and then
yes.
retired from France and moved again
to
a different lab.
Yeah. Anyway, that's something I wish you know it all, anyway.
Yes.
But a number of research people, sort of historical research people, were interested in how the mathematical laboratory was set up in Cambridge.
Yeah, I mean, this was...
It was a novel thing in those days.
A very forward-looking move of your father to look for that.
And somebody's written a history of that somewhere.
Well, Wilkes wrote his memoirs about it. That's part of
right.
it. And then they have... There's a few journal articles that have been written about the... For the 50th anniversary. And
so that's that. Then most of this stuff in here is when my father was principal of this new university up in Kiel. So there are lots of... newspaper cuttings here.
Is it okay to take pictures of this?
Yes, okay.
Can you help us understand what were his motivations when he moved to Kiel, what he was trying to do?
He became very interested in education. Pure, just education, really. And you'll be aware of Cambridge has this collegiate system that... everybody's a member, or many people are members of a college.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a member of Corpus Christi College. He was a fellow of Corpus Christi.
Okay, your father was, okay.
Yeah. So he moved back to Cambridge in about, shall we say, 45. And Then he got going on research again. That's when Pokemon people were there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he felt the need. He'd been in a big job, you know, in the Ministry of Supply. And I don't think he necessarily recalled this, but the mastership of Corpus Christi College came up. And he was a candidate for it, and he didn't get it. And I don't know why he thought he applied then to a number of universities as vice chancellor and that sort of job. And then he was attracted by Keele because it was a new university. They had this very interesting, well, somewhat interesting, scheme in which, in the first, it was a 4-year degree course as opposed to a 3-year degree course. And in the first year, all the students went to a general course, and the classicists did some science, and the sales people did some classics, and he liked this idea. The first principal was called Lord Lindsay. He died, and he was a sort of visionary in education. And I think my father was attracted by this new idea and threw himself into it with great abandon.
So presumably, when he left the Ministry of Supply, it was because he was missing the education.
It was just the end of the war, I think, you know.
Oh, there was no opportunity for him to stay there.
Well, he wouldn't have wanted to stay there. He didn't enjoy his work. I would say he didn't enjoy it, but that was not his idea of how he wanted to spend his life.
Education was...
Well, yes, science was his thing, really.
Okay.
So he was keen to come back to Cambridge and get back to his research. And I don't know. I know he wanted to produce some more general books. I don't understand group theory, but this was, you know, his thing.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to
explain it to chemists.
Explain it, his work.
Okay, so because I was wondering if his move to Keele, in a sense, was just pushing that logical, because he cares so much about education earlier on.
I think he wanted to be in a bigger world. Cambridge is a fairly small world, and Cambridge wouldn't like me to say so, but, you know, it's fairly circumscribed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. He was in his late 50s.
He needed a new challenge.
And he threw himself into this job, and all this is most of these are obituaries, actually. Hello.
In the newspapers.
Hello. How are you getting on?
Well, I don't know. We're chatting away.
Are you? Are you listening to it all on tape?
Sorry?
Are you listening to it all on the...
Yes, it's all recorded.
Oh.
So you're part of history now.
The lunch is ready. I don't know when you'd like to have it.
We can pause.